Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today I'm joined by James Dama. This is our 28th episode looking into mostly Tesla AI, full self-driving beta, and really getting into trying to understand what's going on. So I want to welcome James back on the show. How are you doing?
Doing great. It's great to see you again.
Awesome. Yeah, James. So this is such a privilege, I think, for us to be able to, for me, to be able to ask you about what's happening with full self-driving beta, to kind of explain in, you know, simpler terms of the progress of how Tesla is, you know, tackling this problem. So I wanted to dive into the latest FSD beta. So Tesla just released yesterday, I think it was version 10.11. And I wanted to ask you to kind of go through this update with me, item by item, so we can understand it better. Mostly because when I looked at this, I'm like, wow, this seems like, you know, a pretty decent size update. It has some pretty, you know, good things that are moving the needle forward. And I had a bunch of questions to ask you too. So let's go ahead and dive into it, if you don't mind. Have you gotten the update yourself on your car yet?
No.
No, not yet. Okay. I tried it out for about half an hour yesterday. It seemed a little bit more, the visualization seemed a little bit different, actually, a little bit more clear. I don't know, especially the lane markings. I don't know if it's just because I'm looking for it, you know, or something.
I heard there was some visualization change. Yeah. I watched a couple of YouTube videos, okay, and they definitely have done some refinement on that. An interesting thing to look at would be to see, because they are now using the highlight item in the release notes talked about using a transformer to essentially identify the lanes, especially around intersection or in places where intersections are complicated. It would be interesting to look at the visualization and see if it is doing a better job of sort of delineating and identifying the lane locations and stuff. I mean, that would be kind of one sort of quick way to get an impression about, you know, the degree to which their lane identification capabilities have improved. And the other thing would be, you know, drive it through some intersections and see if it's doing better.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually one thing I was looking at, is how clearly it was detecting lines compared to previous versions. Okay, so let's dive into the first thing. So Andrej Karpathy, Tesla's director of AI, he tweeted that his favorite item from this beta release was upgrading modeling of lane geometry from dense rasters or bag of points to an autoregressive decoder that directly predicts and connects vector space lane points point by point using a transformer neural network. Okay, so can you kind of unpack this in simple terms? Kind of what is kind of this, you know, modeling of lane geometry, and how are they doing it different now compared to before?
So talking about just lane geometry generally, lanes are, understanding a road in terms of lanes is a really useful way of simplifying the problem of deciding what other cars are going to do and what your car is going to do. Because obviously you can drive anywhere there's not a curb or whatever, or anywhere the rules will let you do it. But if you think of the road in terms of lanes, then your decisions are simplified. It's not like exactly where is my car, but which lane am I in? And because the rules about how you move between lanes and how you move, you know, how you use lanes across, especially across intersections, because they're pretty simple, essentially, if you can figure out what the lane structure is in a way that you have a lot of confidence in, it makes the planning part downstream a lot simpler. That is, the planning, so perception is, you know, in the past, I've talked about how you have, you know, perception, planning, and action. And, you know, mostly the neural networks, especially up to now, they've been about perception, like having a car use cameras to understand its environment. Planning is using that understanding that the perception is giving you to come up with a plan of action for how you're going to go about doing, you know, meeting the user's needs as far as moving the car. And the concept of lanes is a really useful simplification. It's something that humans use. Like when you look at lanes, right, when you look at an intersection, you see cars in lanes. You know, this guy's in that lane, that guy's in that lane. If somebody's not in a lane, it's kind of weird. And based on what lane they're in, that leads you to your conclusions about what they're going to do, especially in urban environments where lanes have these lane restrictions and they're very. So understanding lanes well, it's a really important and useful way of simplifying what your understanding of the situation and your options as far as the plan goes. It's also a really good way to be able to predict what other drivers are going to do, because what car, what line a car is in helps you understand. It helps you kind of narrow down what that person is likely to do. They're not absolute, but they're guide points. So lanes are really useful to have. Lanes are also really complicated, right? Because the variety of intersections in the world is just enormous. And so if you had to sit down and write a set of rules, like here's a picture, I'm going to give you a picture of any intersection there is, and you have to write a program. And what that program is going to do is it's going to just figure out what the lanes are. You know, this lane, this is lane 1, 2, 3 on this spot. And your options, if you're in this lane, are to do this, these other things. Like if you just wanted to write that simple program, it would be incredibly complicated. It's on the order. We've talked in the past about the cat and dog question, you know, like you got a grid of colored dots with a picture. Is it a dog? Is it a cat? Well, it turns out writing that program for all dogs and all cats is really, really hard. And similarly, writing that program for all intersections is a really, really hard problem. But up until now, they've been writing that program and it's worked okay. But this is it is one of the things that they had been doing with a regular handwritten heuristic program that was, in a sense, kind of low-hanging fruit. Like it's probably because it's very important. It's kind of a simple, well-defined problem. And it's something where, you know, it like how you want to go about doing it with a neural network is kind of straightforward. So I wanted to talk a little bit about why lanes, like why is that an interesting thing to do? Mm-hmm. So they had been this upgrade, essentially, as I read it, is they had been doing this from the bag of points. So I think we've talked in the past about the way Tesla structures their network, or the way they used to structure networks, the ones I've looked at in the past, where, you know, they have a neural network on each camera, and then the output of those neural networks kind of feeds into a common neural network that combines them to sort of unify what they all see. And then they capture that over time. So you sort of generate this 360 view, and then you watch how it changes over time. And you have a neural network that looks at that over some period of time in the past, and it uses everything that all the cameras saw over the last couple of seconds or something like that. And then it makes decisions about, is this a fire hydrant? Is that a stop sign? And so on. It does that kind of stuff. But the output of all that stuff was this thing that they've been calling the bag of points, which is, I think if you've looked at Tristan, I think he's Rice Fry on Twitter, he did some great stuff where he extracted this from the car. He extracted the bag of points for static objects. And he did some graphics where he showed the car moving through, you know, the bag of points. So the bag of points is, it's kind of like, imagine graph paper in 3D. So you've got like this grid, and it's all around the car. It goes out a couple hundred feet in each direction. And at each one of the points, at each one of the intersections, and say, imagine it's a 1-foot by 1-foot grid or something like that. At every point, what the system was doing, its output, this whole perception system would look at the world, and it would, and for every single point on that 1-foot grid, maybe 10 feet high and 200 feet in each direction, it would tell you what was there. And what was there could be all kinds of things. It could be some object. It could be empty space. It could be a lane marking. So the way the bag of points expresses a lane marking is there's a whole sequence of grid points that say, you know, lane divider, lane divider, lane divider, lane divider. And that was what the C program was getting, right? So in order to turn that into lanes that they could make decisions with, they had to have a C program that would go through that. It would brute force, go through all these points, and it would look for sequences that say lane divider, whatever, and say, oh, that must be a lane. There's my lane divider. And it would convert it in. So you start with a bunch of points which have the property of lane divider, and you want to turn that into a lane divider concept that the planner can use. Because what the planner wants to do is, like, he wants to be able to write a rule that's like, don't cross the lane divider, right? A very simple rule. He doesn't want, you know, the bag of points is a really complicated, very large object that if you write simple rules for how to interpret it, how to turn it into actionable information, is a big, complicated program. And it's got a lot of stuff going on. So one aspect of this, which was the where are the lanes answer, tell me where the lanes are. That part, they built a neural network to do that part. So they no longer have to make their lane decisions based on this big bag of points. Instead, they have a neural network that's just like, here are where the lanes are. So it's got very simple, higher level concepts to work with, not like, you know, a bunch of points, some of which are lane boundaries, but rather just like, here's where the lane boundary is, you know, X, Y, Z coordinates. It's this long, it's in this position. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Okay. So, all right. So to clarify, previously Tesla was, you know, analyzing the scene through their different cameras, and they had neural networks, I'm guessing more like convolutional neural networks that are determining like what's in each kind of box or area of the scene. And so you could say like, you know, lane marking, or they'll look at the various points within that, right? I guess that box or something. And then the planners would take all of those points and then translate them into, let's say the scene more, like where the lanes are and what to do within those lane markings. Is that the general gist of it before?
A little bit. So what was coming out of the big neural network, the BEV network, the one that basically shows the whole unified environment of the car, that is, like I said, imagine you had graph paper and you were drawing a road on it, but you had to do it by drawing solid squares, right? So you go through. So if you were going to draw, you know, where your lane divider is and the lanes at some angle, you go by and you just color all the squares. Well, that was what was coming out before. And then now the planner can't work with that. The planner can't work with a big bunch of dots. The planner itself, it needs some higher level ideas to work from, like there's a lane divider and it's here, don't cross it. Or this is the center of the lane. When I want you to go straight, that means follow the center of the lane, right? That's that's kind of the concept. So where is the center of the lane? And because the planner can't work with a bunch of dots, they needed a program between the bag of points and the planner that would basically look at the bag of points and it would extract, here are where the centers of the lanes are for this intersection that we are at right now. And now, instead of needing that program, that ugly program that probably failed in at weird intersections and stuff like that, they have a neural network that is bringing sort of the strengths of a neural network to this problem. One of those strengths is you train it. And another one is they're flexible and they can interpret stuff from experience. A human being doesn't have to figure out every rule for every possible intersection that you could have and write a list of those rules to convert that bag of points into lanes. Instead, they have a neural network and they show it lots and lots of intersections and you train it. You know, you say in this intersection, this is the right answer. In this intersection, this is the right answer. And eventually you can show it intersections it's never seen before and it can still tell you what the right answer is. So that's where we are. Okay. Now, when he talks about the transformer part of it is just that's what they're using. It's a particular kind of neural network that they're using for this particular function. The transformer in this case is taking that bag of points and it's making it into that drawing of with the lanes.
Okay, so it's still going from the picture or the video to bag of points, and then the transformer is taking it into the lane markings, or is it going directly from the video, do you think, to actually the lane markings?
Probably at this point. So they still produce the bag of points because there are lots of functions aside from the lane function. And most what they had done up to now is they would produce the bag of points. And then they have a bunch of other things that take the bag of points that consume it and turn it into higher level ideas that the planner can use, like car or stop sign or whatnot. So one of those functions, which is the where are the lanes function, they've taken that one function and they've had instead of having a heuristic, a list of rules for how to convert that into the lane, you know, the lane designation, where are the lanes, they train a neural network to do it. So just that one function. So because they've only done one and all the other things are still using the bag of points, probably the way they're doing it right now is they just have it take the bag of points. Now, eventually, once they've converted all the functions away from using the bag of points, instead of having the bag of points as an intermediate, they can take all these things and connect them to the thing that makes the bag of points and just get rid of it. But right now they probably are using the bag of points as an input to this transformer, and the output of this transformer is the lane description.
Okay. So this is the beginning of kind of this shift from the bag of points and then heuristically kind of analyzing all those bag of points into basically having the neural net not just come up with the bag of points, but actually determine the scene, the objects, and lane markings. So from the lane markings, then what's next? Is it going to be other cars, pedestrians, you know, trees? Like, I don't
know.
That's
a good question. What would you do next? I mean, there are a lot of things. Maybe vehicle predictions. That might be something that would be interesting to do. The right way to go to answer that question would be, like, if you knew what was hurting Tesla the most right now, like when they looked at, like, when it doesn't work, why isn't it working? What feature is falling down? And of the features that are falling down, which ones benefit most from being a neural network instead of a heuristic program? And then, because that's the way you'd want to do it. If you had asked me before, I probably wouldn't have picked lanes as the first thing to go. And I think the fact that they did the lanes as the first example probably speaks to two things. One of them is that the lanes were, you know, because of the way they were doing the problem, they were particularly amenable to quickly doing a transformer. And when I say quickly, maybe it took them 6 months, but they had a pretty good understanding of what needed to go in and what needed to come out, and how you could, like, get labeled data to do that training and stuff. But the other thing that would make it important for them to do it is they must have known that they were experiencing enough failures to understand the lane geometry, that if they fix that, it would be a significant improvement to the system. So because I don't know what the root cause of the failures I see when I drive the car, I mean, I can guess about some things. But thinking back in retrospect, we do see a lot of lane-related failures around intersections. I mean, people complain about their car getting in the wrong lane, and they have to turn right, or they have to go straight, or the car not perceiving far enough. You know, if you've had that experience where, you know, you turn right and now you got to do two lane changes to get into the left lane because you got an immediate left coming up. Once the car turns, it has to see the road, understand the lanes, and then act quickly, because you have to make those lane changes relatively quickly. And in the past, it's been really slow about doing that. And part of the reason it might have been slow is because it's not confident, or it takes a lot of processing to figure the lanes out to the extent that it's got the confidence to be able to make decisions and act on them. So, you know, when I get it, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go look at places where I suspect the problems I've experienced were lane related, and see if it does better there. It'll be fascinating to see.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. So why now? Like, why is Tesla, you know, changing over to, you know, lane markings using these transformer neural networks, moving away from the bag of points? Why couldn't they do it earlier? Like, let's say 6 or 12 months ago, were there certain limitations they had in terms of just computation or data, or just, you know, and yeah. So what's the context of why is it happening right now in 2022?
So it's the next thing, I think, is probably the short answer. It's building the whole system from a neural network, building a neural network standpoint. It's too big a thing to bite off all at once. Now, some people do try to bite off the whole thing. They're doing what we call end-to-end, where, you know, they try and plug the camera into one end, build a really big neural network, and just have the steering controls come out the other end, something, you know. And there are people on a limited scale, people have demonstrated that you can make that work. And there are companies, there are robotaxi companies out there that are trying to do that approach. There's some risk to doing it that way. And Tesla decided not to do it that way. Tesla decided instead that they wanted to get something working and get it out there. And on day one, the thing that you know better how to do things with code in the beginning, it may not be perfect, it might be clunky, might fail a lot, maybe you can't get all the features you want, but you know how to do the code. So you start by doing the neural network part that you know exactly how to do, like you've got examples, and then everything that you don't currently know how to do with the neural network, you do that part with regular heuristic code. And that's what they did. Then what they do is they take the next adjacent piece to that neural network, and they make that piece of heuristic code into. So you can think, and I think Andre had this, you know, this an early talk about FS or about autopilot or FSD. He had drawn this box that was mostly green and it had some pink in it. And he said, you know, the small amount of pink is the neural network and the box is autopilot. And he said, over time, you just see that get bigger and bigger. Like the neural network will gradually eat all the other pieces. And that's what we're seeing. And so up until now, the part, you know, the nearest part that hadn't yet been consumed by the neural network was the lanes, right? So that's why we get the lanes now. It, in a sense, they started with a few forward-facing cameras, right? Then they added the other cameras. This is like phases that the project went through. Then they integrated the cameras. Then they integrated the cameras across time. Then they integrated the cameras across time and did the top-down view, the bird's eye view. And that was where we were up until now. And now the next thing is, now we've got this, you know, we have this neural network that built that it can generate this useful bag of points output. But there's some things we want to do with the bag of points that are really hard to do by writing a program. And apparently one of those was the lane, you know, figuring out the lane configuration. And so that was amenable to training a neural network to do it. So they did that part next.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So with the bag of points, is one of the disadvantages or challenges kind of the lack of persistence, or like you have, you know, from frame to frame, it could be different. There might not be the lane markings, or there might be an occlusion, like something blocking it. And so you don't have perhaps the permanence of knowing, you know, what's going on. Is that one of the disadvantages?
That would not be one of the disadvantages of it, because you can achieve persistent. The bag of points output from the neural network is capable of. I mean, here's the thing that you see sometimes when you're driving in your car. Like if you have 10, you know, 10.10 or earlier, your car has the bag of points. And I don't know if you've noticed, but sometimes if you're driving down the freeway and there's a big lane divider that you can't see across between you and the oncoming traffic, and you look down at your display, it's guessing what the lanes are on the other side of this wall that it can't see. I mean, it's pretty common for it to drive along a wall or come to an intersection where something is occluded. And the neural network on the mind of computer display that you see in the center, it will nonetheless guess what's on the other side, right? And similarly, if a pedestrian is occluded temporarily by some obstacle, it will still imagine the pedestrian there, even though it can't see it. So we have direct evidence that the bag of points representation right now has persistence. And Andre has said that it does. And we've seen evidence that it does that. And it makes sense that it would, because you're getting persistence by extrapolating from, you know, the last couple of seconds that you saw. So even if you, because as soon as you build the version of the network that has kind of the last couple of seconds of memory or the last couple of hundred feet of motion memory, because they do both. Apparently they do one where it remembers the last couple of seconds, and then they have another chunk of memory, which is the last, 100 feet or something. It's the last distance. And the reason they do that is if the car stopped at a light, it's okay to forget what happened in the last few seconds, but not okay to forget what happened in the last few feet. So part of the memory only updates as it moves, and the other part of the memory updates with time. Anyway, once you have that persistence, like that concept of time that the network is, that it is dealing with, then it pretty much automatically can, extrapolate from occluded objects, because it will make sense to do that. Right. Because it's got time now. It has this concept of movement. You know, I mean, movement is a characteristic of objects in time. If there's no time, there's no movement, right? So once the neural network has time, which it has now, it has movement, and with movement you can get occlusion. So all those concepts kind of drop out of that thing. So bag of points doesn't fundamentally get you that. You want me to talk about what bag of points does get you?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. So the biggest thing that Bag of Points gets you is that Bag of Points is really hard to write software to deal with for a lot of things, not for every single thing, but for a lot of things. Figuring out which of the points in your Bag of Points corresponds to a particular car. I mean, I think once before I used this description of two pedestrians. If your Bag of Points has a blob of points moving along that are labeled pedestrian, but your planner wants to know if it's one or two pedestrians, and if one of them is a child or maybe one is a dog or something like that, you have to have a piece of software that basically goes through all those points and tries to figure out based on the shape of the points if, like, is an adult, is it two people? And for, like, pedestrians, that's tough because they come in all kinds of sizes and shapes, and they can have blowing clothes and they can be carrying bags and stuff. So writing a program to identify pedestrians and Bag of Points is just really, really hard to do. But training a neural network to do it, the neural network is just going to nail that problem. It's going to be really good at it. And the lane lines is one of those things where writing the program is much harder than it seems like it's going to be. So that's the biggest thing that the Bag of Points, that getting rid of the Bag of Points gets you. Mm-hmm. Another thing that the Bag of Points is these handwritten pieces of code, they're mostly running on the CPU. They're not running on this big NNU for the most part. So the hardware 3, it has GPUs for doing graphics type processing, or they're, you know, classic GPU type processors. It has CPUs, which are, like, you know, that's the sort of classic omnipurpose compute unit. And then they also have these neural networking units in there. And the neural networking units, if you look at the relative capacity of these things, the neural networking unit is like 10,000 times more powerful than the CPU is in terms of how many operations it can do. So if you can, so for hardware 3, if you can frame a problem as a neural network problem, you have a lot more computational capacity you can use. So the efficiency of the system goes up a lot. So it's easier to write because you're training it instead of having to write a long list of rules. It's a better fit to the hardware that Tesla has. That's another thing that you get out of it. Honestly, the most important thing is if you pick the right problems, the neural network is just going to do a way better job. You can hit lower errors, better accuracy, better precision. And if you've got that, then you do a better job of driving because you're planning the downstream policy. It takes the perceptions and it decides what it's going to do. But one of the things it always has to take into consideration is how confident are we in those perceptions? Like, if the camera is telling me, if the perception system is telling me there's a pedestrian in front of the car, how confident, you know, and it, the planner might know what the confidence ratio is, but the higher your confidence is, the more smoothly you're going to be able to move through the world. Like, one of the things that FSD and autopilot has suffered from and that we see improve over time is that the system, you know, especially when they roll in a new feature, it's not confident. Like, it has, you know, the thing is saying, you know, there's a stop sign with 92% confidence. I'm 92% confident there's a stop sign. And the planner has to be, okay, well, what do I do with a 92% confidence of a stop sign? Well, depending on your circumstances, you probably stop, right? But there might be some situations where you don't stop. But it would be a lot better if it was 99.999%. Like, you can, the planner can make much more simple decisions if it can do that. So, you know, right now when your car comes to a stop sign and you're turning onto a faster road and it has to look down and see if there's a car coming, well, it wants pretty high confidence that there's no car coming before it starts the turn. And if the accuracy of the system isn't very high, it might have to wait a long time before. So the system seems kind of jerky, and I mean, it lacks confidence. It literally lacks confidence in what it's seeing. And that makes the job of the planner harder. So switching to using a neural network and to doing this kind of stuff is going to give you much better characterized probabilistic outputs. And there's a very good chance that you're just going to get better accuracy. So the whole thing is just going to get smoother.
Interesting. Okay. I think segueing off of that, Karpathy in his tweet actually talks about some of the benefits. So I want your translation on this. It says, this enables us to predict crossing lanes, allows computational cheaper and less error-prone post-processing, and paves the way for predicting many other signals and their relationships jointly and end-to-end. So it seems like, I mean, a lot of that seems like kind of what you're saying is, mm-hmm. you know, computational cheaper because it's going on the neural net side, less error prone, right? You're getting more confident. And predicting crossing lanes, what does that mean? Is that like okay. when you're turning at an intersection or something yeah. or?
So imagine, you know, as I said, you're writing these rules, you're at an intersection mm-hmm. and you're the guy writing the program and the car, you know, is producing a top-down map of an intersection. Let's say it's some funky intersection. It's part of a roundabout. It's got a couple of driveways off of it. Part of it curves. There's a road that comes in at a weird angle. And you have a bunch of lanes coming into this, right? And now you have to write a program that basically says for every lane that enters and exits this intersection, like, you know, where does it go through the intersection? Well, when you're talking about the lane on the part of the road, you know, that's approaching the intersection, figuring out the lanes is a lot more straightforward because there's some lines. Or if there aren't lines, you can guess from the way the cars are parked or how wide the space is or something like that, right? About whether is this two lanes or one lane. Once you get to an intersection and you get into that space in the middle, it's really hard to write the rules, right? Like extrapolating from a straight line on one side to the other. Now, humans do it. We look at this situation. We've got tons of it. You know, we've got a neural network in our head that's been trained to look at intersections. And when you get a weird intersection, you got a pretty good sense of like what lane goes where, the crossing points in the middle. But if you're writing a program that's looking at a bunch of pixels in the middle of a big empty intersection that doesn't have any stripes or whatnot, figuring out where the line goes from one side to the other, that's tough. So the crossing lanes bit of the lane problem is one of the especially difficult aspects of it. And so it sounds like from the way that he worded this, that they weren't even really trying to do it before. They would have the lanes up to the intersection and the lanes out of the intersection. And then they would have some rules that would kind of guess, you know, like which one's connected on one side connected to the other side or which one's in a turn connected to which one's on the turn. And now they've got a system that's just like drawing lines through the intersection for the possible tracks that you can reasonably follow. And so that's going to make the job of the planner a lot simpler.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a big deal. I mean, if you can connect, you know, the lane that you're in yeah. with the lane you're supposed to be in post after the intersection. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like it potentially could, you know, help with a lot of intersection problems.
With just the scale to, you know, constrain that, right? This, its biggest benefit is in the weird intersections, right? Because the simple intersections, like, you know, if you got two-lane roads crossing at a couple of stop signs or something like that, that's a pretty simple problem. Like a human can write the rules that say this lane goes to that lane or to this one. And if you turn left, it can go to that one and so forth, right? You can write that. But, you know, writing those rules for all possible intersections is really tough. And the place the neural network really wins is those weird ones where if you had written a program, it wouldn't have worked very well. So in those situations previously, the planner, you know, the planner kind of knows, oh, this is one of those weird intersections that I hate, you know. And so its confidence is going to be really low when it deals with those things. And it's going to make more errors because the accuracy is just lower. Mm-hmm. So the win, that's where I would expect to see the significant, you know, I have an intersection that I have to drive through coming home every day. And on 10.9, the car never got it. It always wanted to turn into the neighbor's drive. Because it's like it's this crossing intersection, but then there's this driveway that leaves the intersection. It's not like from the street. There's like a corner of the intersection turns into a driveway. And the intersection itself is on the crest of a hill. So as you approach the intersection, you can't see the other sides. You have to kind of guess what it is until you get right up to the top. So the car could never do a smooth transition. And you could see it be going through that intersection like, is that the road or is that the road? And so you'd be like three quarters of the way through before it figured out. On 10.10, it got a lot better. And that's the kind of situation. In fact, I drove through Yosemite on FSD a few weeks back, and I just let the car drive the whole thing. And it only failed in one spot. It was very similar to this thing that I was saying, you know, there were two roads that came. None of them had any lane markings. You had to figure out what the roads were just on the basis of like where there was asphalt and gravel or grass or something like that. And there was like a little building that was off the corner, and it had a little driveway that came down and met the other asphalt like right at the intersection. So it was kind of part of the intersection. As a human, you drive through there and you know that driveway, you can ignore it. But apparently FSD didn't figure that out, right? It was the closest to straight way to exit the intersection. And so the car just happily like went right down, you know, exited the road and went right up the drive, this dirt driveway, basically, right? Or it would have if I'd let it, you know, I was paying attention and I intervened. But, you know, I thought that was the one failure that I had all the way through Yosemite, driving like all the way in and all the way out on autopilot, no interventions. That was the one that screwed up. And that was a lane failure, essentially. Right. So, I mean, I'm not going back to Yosemite next week, but the next time I go through, it'll be really interesting to see how it, you know, the car does there.
Yeah. So, okay. In a scenario of a blind left or a left turn, right, into, let's say, a busy intersection. Do you think in previous versions that because it didn't have, let's say, confidence in which lane to turn into, that it would be more timid to make that blind left turn? And then with this update or potential future updates as well, if they're more confident, not just with, like, with connecting their current lane with their future lane, that it could make that blind left, those left... unprotected left turns more confident. Is that kind of a reasonable?
Well, imagine if the car is 100%, you know, confident of exactly what the line is that it needs to follow through an intersection, it's not going to have any hesitation. Like, it doesn't need to hesitate. If it hesitates, it's because it doesn't have confidence at some point. And the confidence in what it's doing, it's the consequence of a whole lot of observations, each one of which has a probabilistic confidence on it. Right. And so, you know, the planner, a lot of the planner is heuristic right now. And the, you know, the team of people that writes that, they have to set thresholds. Like, how confident do I have to be that there's nothing in front of me before I proceed? 90%, 92%. And that might depend on what's in front of you. Like, do I think that's a speed bump or do I think that's a pedestrian? Right. Because your reaction is very different. So, we talk about the pedestrian thing too. I think that we see some improvements in that in one of these lines. So confidence is super important. Mm-hmm. Confidence, whether it's heuristically written code or a neural network, the output is going to be probabilistic. Even if you don't intend to write the code to be probabilistic, you know, you will test the code and it will fail a certain fraction of the time. And so you as the developer, you will know it is probabilistic. It has a certain failure rate. And you have to take that failure rate, depending on the circumstances, into account before you decide to take an action that might be dangerous to somebody or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. So Karpathy in this second tweet, he says, it paves the way for predicting many other signals and their relationships jointly in end-to-end. So what does that mean? It paves the way for predicting many other signals. What are those signals?
So a signal is, this is just an output, right? Okay. A signal to the planner. You could think of it in those terms, right? So I talked about the lanes and it could be lights. It could be like other moving objects and that kind of stuff. These are all different facets of the problem of understanding the environment that this could be applied to. So they took this transformer network and they used it just for the lane problem for now. But now that they've figured out how to use a transformer effectively in this situation, a transformer is an interesting tool to use for this. And we can talk a little bit later about why transformers. But they haven't used transformers to do this kind of thing before. As far as I know, Tesla hasn't. So they kind of want to get one working and see how it works in the real world, and polish their skills for being able to get it to solve a problem. And then once they understand how to get it good performance out of it, they can start replicating that to other signals that they also want to do this with. So that's how I interpret that thing that he's saying. So then the other thing about so that's the comment about being able to apply it to other signals. He talks about allows predictions to be jointly coherent due to sequential conditioning.
So this is that's the kind of the TLDR tweet by Andre. So here it says a GPT-like transformer is now predicting the lanes and their connectivity. This direct-to-vector space framework allows predictions to be jointly coherent due to sequential conditioning and very easily used by planner due to sparsity.
Yeah, so jointly coherent means he's kind of conflating two things here, but jointly coherent means it can be coherent in the context of all the other things I'm saying. So for instance, you build these different outputs, right? One for the lanes, one for, imagine you're coming to an intersection and you can't see it very well and the pavement markings aren't very good and you're not sure if there's a crosswalk, right? Well, as you approach the intersection, if a pedestrian steps out and starts walking across, the probability that there's a crosswalk there is higher. So you want to jointly condition your estimate of whether that there's a crosswalk there on not just the pavement markings and the shape of the intersection, but also the presence of the pedestrian. So writing software, like if a human has to write that program, that human has to like figure out an interface to the pedestrian part of the program afterwards that you have. In other words, like don't care so much. So, you know, you're a noun and a verb have a kind of relationship that is important, or like, you know, an adjective that modifies a noun, like that noun's meaning is strongly dependent on that adjective and maybe less dependent on other things in other phrases or whatnot. So the idea with attention was that when you evaluate one part of the thing you're looking at, you figure out, you have a part of the network that figures out what other parts are likely to be important when I do this. So that was the attention mechanism, essentially. So transformers were this language model, essentially. They were really, and in fact, GPT and BERT, all of the really, you know, impressively high performant language models are out there. They're transformers. And most transformers, they have very similar structure to all the other transformers out there. There's a pattern to them. They have little tricks and stuff that get mixed in. But there is this very distinct concept called the transformer. It's a sequence network, and it has an attention layer, and it uses attention to improve its performance. So a few years ago, somebody was just like, hey, what if I run a picture through a transformer, right? Because it sounds dumb. We look at pictures, and pictures aren't sequences, like really obviously. Like anybody will look at a picture, and it's a grid, right? So they basically did this trick where they took the picture and they broke it into patches, and they called each patch a word, and then they fed it through a transformer as a sequence, and it worked great. People were shocked. Anyway, so people started thinking, man, this transformer thing, I wonder what else we can do with it. Anyway, so transformers, people have gotten really excited about transformers. Yeah. It is a really interesting kind of convergence, and they have a lot of cool characteristics in terms of generality, and they have a kind of ease of use. They are kind of CPU hogs. I mean, they're not, it's not all upside. They have some downsides to them too, but you know, so we know Tesla at AI Day told us that they were looking at using transformers in other places. They had a part of the presentation where they were talking about stuff that they had been doing, and then these certain parts of the neural network of the system where they weren't sure, and they were trying these different things. And one of the things they were trying was a transformer. So we knew that they were looking at them. Andre's talked about them quite a bit, and they're kind of an obvious thing to try. Like if you're the kind of, let's throw a bunch of things at the wall and see what works well, well, you're definitely going to try a transformer, like, because we're just that place. So,
when did transformers kind of start to get used a lot with images and video? Is that more recent
a couple years, basically. Okay. It's a super recent thing. Mm-hmm. And the jury's still out on whether transformers are actually qualitative. Well, a thing that often happens in the research field is like somebody comes up with some improvement on some other thing somebody else did, right? And they're like, wow, look how great this works. And then the people on plan B was like, I don't know if that's because your system is actually better, because you did these other tricks too. And what if we do those tricks to our thing? So then they'll go back to their thing and they'll do some tricks. And they're like, look, it works. It actually works better than your thing. And then the guys on plan B will be, you added this other thing. And then they'll add that thing to theirs. And so there'll be this back and forth. And a thing that seems to be true is once the networks get big enough, lots of different shapes actually work pretty well. So whether transformers, I am pretty skeptical that transformers, the way they're done today, are actually qualitatively better than a convolutional neural network, you know, which is properly done. They might be quicker to get working. They might have other advantages, right? That's not to say that they're perfectly equivalent, but just from a you know, like what's the fewest number of neurons that I can use? What's the least amount of computation to get me a good result? My guess is that CNNs would probably win. And CNNs probably aren't the perfect thing. There's a few different kinds of architectures that people have looked at a lot. There's plenty of code out there. There's plenty of theory for how to use them and that kind of stuff. And they tend to get used over and over again because writing this code is really hard. So researchers, they'll take some other guy's code and change a couple of things, and then they'll do a new experiment with it. So we're nowhere near exploring all the possible networks out there. But, you know, I think we're unlikely to stop at transformers. I mean, maybe there will be variations on transformers that will be the thing. But right now, transformers are popular and they have some really interesting benefits. And Tesla decided to go with a transformer on this particular thing. And it's not a big surprise. But there are probably other ways they could have done it, too.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting how it seems like the whole field of, you know, with the neural nets, like they're like, you'd think that language and images are completely separate and different, yeah. But like, it just seems like there's a convergence, you know, where similar neural nets can both do both language and, you know, images and video. It's just like mind boggling.
Yeah. There's a very interesting biological precedent for this. And in fact, the fact that these things are general kind of inspires a lot of people to look at biology and say, maybe neural networks are a good model for biology because they also have this property. And experiments have been done where you can you know, essentially rewire a mammal's brain to connect something to something else. And people, you know, the experiment has been done to rewire a mouse's brain or some lizard's brain or something to connect like their odd, you know, to connect the nerve from their ear into their visual cortex or to connect an arm to the visual cortex or something like that. And an interesting thing that we find is it does seem to be the case that, at least as far as the neocortex is concerned, you can plug anything in anywhere and the brain will figure out how to deal with it. Like the visual cortex is especially surprising because it has a regular structure to the way its neurons are connected that isn't present in many other parts of the cortex. So the fact that you can take a non-visual input and connect it to the vision center in the brain and the vision center will figure out how to make it work is an amazing demonstration of how plastic, of how dynamically flexible, you know, brain tissue is. And we're now seeing that neural networks do this too. Like, you know, you may suffer some degradation of efficiency, but, you know, if you got a big blob of neurons, you can connect it together lots of different ways and it'll get you some results and they might not be bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I was watching some video, I think, but it was saying how Andre Karpathy tweeted out, I think in 2020, this paper, I'm not sure if it was by Google Brain, but it was talking about using transformers to, you know, for images or video. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how Tesla is really kind of on the forefront, like using the latest technology, using the latest methods. And my suspicion is that, you know, like with Andre being like reading the latest papers and knowing what's going on, my suspicion is he's also recruiting some of these people too, you know, to his team, those who, you know, are having kind of, you know, being in the forefront of, let's say, using transformers for, you know, images or video. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we're not privy to any of that information on who's joining, you know, Tesla's team and their background, but it just seems like, yeah, it would be fascinating to know, you know, some of that
I'm sure
background.
It's a good recruiting, just having Andre. Andre's a very popular guy in the space. I mean, he taught like one of the most popular classes at Stanford for a long time. And you know, he's super well-liked. His blogs are, you know, he's just like, he's in a really impressively relatable guy who has good connections for people. Just having Andre is probably a huge draw, I think.
Yeah. There was this tweet by Elon where he said, like, people who join Tesla's AI, they're sometimes are surprised at how advanced Tesla's AI is or something. Mm-hmm. And I took that as, oh, they're getting some really high quality Tesla like AI talent who's coming to Tesla. And they're like, whoa, you guys actually, you know, have a legit, like, you know, AI team here. It's like,
I mean, I get this. I have this same problem where you don't hear anything for a long time. And, you know, I mean, they've got 100 smart, like no matter how smart you are, they've got 100 smart guys and you're going to get there and they're going to thought of have thought of all kinds of things that you didn't think of, because they're thinking about it every day. And there are a whole lot of people who are really focused on the problem. So, you know, for like, I spend a lot of time thinking, and not as much as I used to. Back when Autopilot first came out, and before I saw any of the neural networks, and I was just driving the car like a maniac trying to figure out what they were doing, I spent all this time thinking about all these things that they were doing. And then I saw, you know, there were certain aspects of when I saw the network, I was like, ah, is that all they're doing? But then there were other things that, like, wow, that is really freaking cool. Like that's from a paper from 3 months ago, right? I mean, I think the lead time is probably longer now than it used to be. But occasionally I would see stuff where, like, it really looked like they put something in a car that was literally a paper that just got published like 4 months ago, and they already had it in the car. Right. An idea from a paper that, at least as far as I could tell, it seemed like it was really recent.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. So there was a bunch of other updates for version 10.11 beta. Were there any other things that were kind of that stuck out to you? The thing that stuck out for me was also the it said the improvement or improved the precision of VRU vulnerable.
Tar lines.
Detections.
My pet peeve, yeah.
Exactly, by 44%, dramatically reducing spurious false positive pedestrians and bicyclists, especially around tar seams, skid marks, and raindrops. Yeah. So this is exactly what you were mentioning on your drive.
The tar seams, I didn't see the raindrops thing. I was driving in places that were dry. But man, it was we had a long stretch of highway that was going down a hill, and there were the pairs of these truck skid marks. And every time we saw one, we would get the pedestrian. I mean, it was a certain road with the light a certain way. The pavement was a certain color, you know. So like, because this road was super consistent, there weren't any trees or anything. We're just like driving through the desert, right? So every time you saw a set of skid marks, it was like every other set of skid marks, and every set of skid marks was triggering that. Yeah, we would bray, you know, because we would see it like coming, yeah. Right, and be like, okay, here we go. And you'd get the pedestrian warning.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting. Last time we talked, you said, you know, you're optimistic is like, this is a relatively straightforward problem to solve, right? And it seems like they're saying like this was accomplished by increasing the data size of the next gen auto labeler, training network parameters that were previously frozen, and modifying the network loss functions. To me, I mean, it seems like it's basically they're just training the neural network, right? With data.
They're tweaking it slightly. I mean, so when they train not all parts of the neural network get trained on all inputs and outputs. In fact, one of the interesting innovations that Tesla has done is they've figured out how to partition. They've got this big, almost monolithic, very large monolithic neural network, but they don't train everything equally. They don't train it in a simple fashion. They'll do a thing where they want to train some part of the network on some chunk of data. And so what they do is they lock the rest of the network down, so it won't learn as you do this stuff, right? So, you know, they had some network parameters that they weren't training when they were doing this pedestrian task, this, you know, identifying VRUs, right? And apparently that was a mistake. They should have been training those too. So, you know, they figured that out and they turned them on. And so that was part of it. They changed the loss function, which, you know, loss, you know, that's a thing you do. You play around with loss functions if you're not getting exactly what you want. And the loss function is to what degree is a thing, like if when you're training a neural network and you give it an input and it gives you an output, and the output's always wrong to some extent, right? But exactly, you're going to give it a number back that says exactly how wrong it is. Well, how do you calculate that number? Well, like, imagine it's a box around a pedestrian, right? You asked it to draw a box around a pedestrian in a picture. And, you know, you decided the right answer is this box, and it gives you a box that's slightly different. Well, what is the number associated with how bad that is? And you can imagine there's different ways of calculating that, right? And so that's what the loss function is. The loss function is, how do you convert what it said into a number that captures how wrong it was? So, you know, a pretty common thing to do is to discover that if you change the loss function a little bit, that you get better performance. And essentially what it's doing is, it's trading off precision and recall in different kinds of situations. And so there are situations you might not care about as much, and you might be willing to sacrifice those in order to get better at situations you care more about, right? So tweaking the loss function lets you do that.
Okay. Okay, so wait, tweaking loss function, so how do they do that? I mean, like, so I mean, my kind of crude understanding of loss function is like how, what the accuracy or error rate, right, is on the output. But so I guess, what do you do to tweak that loss function?
What do you do? That's probably more art than any, well, especially in the case of really big neural networks where you're, because a particular, unlike a very simple thing, you know, if all I'm doing is like, is it a cat or a dog? And the cat is yes or no. Then there's just a question of like, if it says 90% cat and it was a cat, you know, how wrong, it's like, it, I guess with cat, with classification problems, it's actually pretty straightforward. It's a pretty well understood, but in any output that's not a simple number or a simple yes or no, you have to decide how you're going to convert that into the number that you feed back in the network to tell it it was wrong. Because if it's really wrong, you want to give it more negative feedback than if it's just slightly wrong. And and there's different, a loss function also, it has to be something that will encourage the neural network to get better when it's really bad. And it also has to be able to encourage a neural network to get better when it's actually pretty good and you still want it to keep getting better. And it's important to be consistent about how you calculate those errors. So the shape of that loss function, like how it changes as the goodness or badness of the neural network changes, is an important component for being able to maintain your, it's a, training a neural network is often described as gradient search, which is, you know, essentially, in a simple way, what you're doing is you take an input and you tweak it just a little bit one way or the other, and you see if the neural network is better or worse based on that. And that lets you understand what the shape of the error function is for that image. And so what you do is you go downhill, right, to make the error less. And that's so the slope there at that particular point is the gradient. And gradients in more than one dimension are slopes in more than two dimensions are called gradients. So you want to follow the gradient down. Well, the better the neural, well, when the neural network is really, really terrible, sometimes you've got no gradient at all. Like, it's really hard to tell, like, what do I change to get better? Like, I'm so bad and I've got a billion parameters. So being able to have some kind of gradient when it's really terrible, that's a huge challenge. So coming up with a loss function that gives you a gradient, even when the neural network is terrible, like, that's one really important thing to do. And then the other thing is, like, when you're really getting close, like when it's really good and the errors are really small, it still it needs to have a slope. And you still, if the slope isn't steep enough, you won't improve very fast. So coming up with a function that, you know, continuously improves, but gives you a decent slope when you're terrible, and also gives you a decent slope when you're good. So people do this, like, there are these very brute force things, just like root mean squared, you know, like, you know, from doing simple linear regression, you just, you know, how good your line is a fit to a bunch of points, is just an RMS error, right? But there are lots of other things that you can do, energy functions, and you can look at the entropy of the output. And those different loss functions will have different characteristics in terms of how they evolve as, you know, a particular problem, as a particular neural network goes from being really terrible to pretty good. So it's a super complicated question to answer. I give you a really long nonsensical answer.
Already. I hear you. Okay. So another update from this version 10.11 says, improved right-of-way understanding if the map is inaccurate or the car cannot follow navigation. In particular, modeling intersection extends is now entirely based on network predictions and no longer uses map-based heuristics. So when I read this, it sounds like previously, you know, it seems like the maps were an important part of planning it with heuristically, but they're becoming less dependent on that, especially at intersections. Is that kind of the
gist? Yeah, that's how I read that. I mean, we've known for a long time, and it's still the case that what's in the map that the car downloads, in a lot of situations, it defers to the map over its own perceptions. And the classic one is a speed limit sign. You drove past the speed limit sign, it said 60. Why is your car going 35? Right? Because there's, you know, if there's an error in the map and the speed is wrong, or if you're on the freeway and your GPS is off a little and the car thinks it's on a surface street, you know, you get the wrong speed limit. Those drive people crazy. And they're a clear example of where it's giving the map precedence over the over its own perception. So you could imagine that, like, when they were first doing stop sign detection, you know, they're seeing the stop sign and then there's looking in the map database, and the map database says there's a stop sign at this intersection. It's supposed to say there's a stop sign at the intersection. And if you're still in the phase where you're still working on your stop sign detection, then it's not good enough, right? You write your code so that, well, if the map says there's a stop sign, stop anyway, even if you don't see it, right? And as it gets better, and this is the thing, as your stop sign detection gets better and better and better, eventually it's almost perfect. Then you can stop paying attention to the map because the map's not really helping you anymore. And map errors are real. I mean, the maps of the roads are super complicated. If you look at map databases, a chunk of road, it'll have hundreds, sometimes thousands of characteristics. And, you know, these are created, they're often created by algorithms that look at like satellite images, or they'll have a car drive a bunch of roads and then they'll have some computer program go through and pick out the, you know, where the stop signs are. So there's a lot of automated production of these maps, and they get edited by people by hand, and they end up with errors, and the errors can be super annoying. And sometimes they can create, you know, serious problems with being able to navigate your car around. Humans don't use maps when we drive down the road. Like, no matter whether my map says there's a stoplight or not, I'm going to stop if there's a stoplight, right? I don't need it. So this is a really long-winded way of saying, when they stop using maps, it's a strong sign that they're becoming much more confident about their perception. Because there are lots of situations where the perception has to be really good before you're willing to ignore the maps. So, you know, they now have this important situation, which is at intersections where they need to understand right of way. You know, so if you're coming to an intersection and the map says the right turn lane says you can go straight, but the perception system says the sign says I can't, it won't try to go straight there.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I mean, all this sounds like it's kind of like neural nets are eating the heuristic part of the code, right? It's this, yeah. What Andre Karpathy is saying, software 2.0 is eating the software 1.0. And it's just methodologically, just one by one, one area. As the neural nets get more accurate, better in performance, they can take over the heuristic side. Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, overall, it sounds like a pretty, you know, interesting bullish update. Tesla is pushing forward, you know, with their intended plans. Any other kind of, I mean, there was one part where it said about using simulated adversarial high-speed VRU interactions.
That was cool.
To kind of reduce the velocity error of very close by motorcycle scooters, wheelchairs, and pedestrians by 63%. So what are they doing there? Are they just using simulation to, like, popping up, you know, pedestrians in the road and training the network off of that? Or
I mean, this is a really good example of where you want to use a simulator, right? If you're approaching a VRU, a pedestrian, a motorcyclist, whatever, at speed, I mean, this happens every day. You drive past somebody, a cyclist, right? You're on a road that has a 40-mile-an-hour speed limit, and there's a cyclist who's pedaling along the curb, and you're in the rightmost lane. You're going to pass him, and you're going to be going like 40 miles an hour faster. Like, that's a very high-speed interaction. The car needs to be able to predict with great accuracy whether that person is about to move into your lane. They need to be, you know, the car needs to see that cyclist and estimate where they are and what direction they're moving in. And it needs to do it quickly because you don't have a lot of time because you're moving relatively, you're coming up on them quickly, and you need to get it right because you're coming up on them quickly. So, how much data are you going to get on that? Especially the ones that are really close, because, you know, cyclists accidentally weaving in front of your car, like, that doesn't happen every day. So if it's something that they want a lot more data than they can easily get, because this is an important thing to get right. Simulate it, You know, they make a parameterized model where you can just make zillions of fake versions, you know, computer simulated versions of a guy in a wheelchair falling into the street, or just as you're coming up really fast, or a kid chasing a ball out into the street, or a cyclist. So you can do that in simulation a bunch of times. And then you can combine that those simulated interactions with your real world interactions. And if you do it right, you improve the accuracy. So that, I mean, this is at AI Day, they showed us using a simulator, and, you know, the family running down the street or the moose in the crosswalk or whatever. I mean, those are rare, but probably not super important. But the moose thing, that's probably pretty important. Like, seeing mooses, being able to recognize a moose when you see it, like, that's an important thing for the car to be able to do. But, you know, playing well with VRUs, like, that is way up there. That is a super high priority. And they probably have a hard time getting lots of data in situations that they think are really important, but where there's just, that doesn't happen much in the real world, but you want to be prepared for it anyway.
Yeah, it makes sense. So I'm curious, what do you think Tesla is going to be tackling next? It seems like one of the themes is, you know, expanding the neural nets. So perhaps using transformer networks to identify
certainly
objects.
I mean, and cars, Andre's basically people, saying they're going to need more of them. Mm-hmm. So there'll be more, maybe separate transformer networks. Maybe they'll be combined with this transformer network. And I would expect in the long run that the bag of points goes away. It might take a while. I wouldn't be surprised if there are all kinds of little things they've got in there that depend on the bag of points right now. So it might take them a little while to get rid of it. But I think eventually it probably does go away. And when it goes away, that'll be good, because training through the bag of points is kind of hard right now. It's kind of a discontinuity when you have code in the middle of your neural network. The more neural network you've got, the better it all plays together, because neural network doesn't play well with code when it's embedded in the middle of it.
Got it.
Yeah. So, you know, the one stack to rule them all, we still don't have it. I would like to see you almost don't need FSD on the highway. Like, many of the things that FSD is really impressively good at are much less relevant on the highway as it is. Getting a single stack to get to run on the highway and also on surface streets, I think, is probably going to be a pretty useful thing. I think I developed this theory recently that expanding the grid, that bag of points thing, it has a certain X dimension and Y dimension. And the bigger it gets, the more computationally expensive it is to run it in the car. But unless it gets us to, it has to be able to look a certain distance ahead of your car, and the faster you drive, the farther it has to go. And I think that might be a big part of why, you know, FSD can't be used faster than 65. And they really don't even like to use it that fast, right? They'd really rather you didn't use it on the highway, because they have to make the grid bigger and the computational cost is high for doing that. And the training cost is high and that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's a feature of V11 that we've heard about for a while. And I was hoping to see it sooner rather than later. Apparently it's hard. They've been talking about it for quite a while. And so I suspect they're banging away at that problem and making slow progress on it. Or maybe they decided that what they were doing wasn't going to work and they needed to rip it out and rewrite it a different way. That's also possible. In the near term, I would expect to see more of these, more of these little transformers for sure. But there's a zillion things. Like, so many of the notes are, oh, we made this 10% better, that 20% better. That's going to be a huge chunk. I mean, the experience of driving it is going to keep getting better and better, because the neural network accuracies are just going to continue going up. And when the neural network accuracy goes up, that allows the people who build the planner to take advantage of that by making the driving smoother, mm-hmm. because it's more confident about what's going on. So a lot of what we're going to see is just going to be this kind of, you know, continuous smooth improvement in hundreds of little things that we experience. And occasionally we'll get a big feature upgrade. So this one, I'm hoping to see that intersection behavior is significantly better, and also that its ability to like do quick. It's getting better. It hasn't been good in the past at making quick lane changes when it really needed to. It's surprisingly good at planning for lane. In fact, I had this today. I was running some errands on FSD, which incidentally is almost zero intervention for me in my town. I tend to not drive when there, you know, I don't drive during the rush hour in the morning and whatnot because I work from home. But yeah, I almost never. I ran three errands this morning. I kept my hand on the steering wheel, but I didn't have to do anything. The car did all the drives. And there are some, it's getting better. Anyway, I've been pretty happy with it. The degree of confidence that it does maneuvers with, especially lane changes in traffic, is getting a lot better in my opinion.
Interesting. Awesome. Great, man. I feel like talking about this stuff, I get a better grasp of,
you know, open car doors is going to be good. I'm just looking at the other ones.
Yeah. If there's anything else you have of note,
it's your turn.
That'd be interesting.
I guess we did the big ones.
Yeah. I mean there's a bunch of them, other points as well.
Yeah, and the list probably only includes like the 10 most important or 20 most important one. My experience with doing these kind of, multi-week improvements on a big program is the actual number of issues that you've addressed is probably like 300. But, 250 of them you can't even explain to your boss, much less your customer.
yeah, that makes sense. Awesome. Yeah, I was just saying, actually talking with you, it helps, I think, just decode some of the stuff that's happening, the updates, also seeing where Tesla's headed, why they're doing what they're doing, you know, their homework ahead. But yeah, ultimately, it feels very bullish, you know, optimistic. Tesla is, they're not slowing down. They're doing what they set out to do, you know, like they've laid it out, the goal, and they're just...
It's happening.
Aggressive. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's the point. It's a first time. It's one of those first time things. It's hard to know externally if things are going well or not because you don't know how it's supposed to go. Right? We don't have anything to compare it to. I'm super happy to see continued progress. My own experience. And I really feel like, you know, the most important test is you drive the car. And is it getting better for you over time or not? Like that steady progress is important. It'll be great when they get some of these big block changes that seem like they're significant, but it's kind of at a point right now. There's some features that they don't have. Like it's not great in parking lots. It doesn't do people's driveways and that sort of stuff that need to be done. But the city street driving part, you could kind of imagine that it just keeps getting incrementally better over some period of time and eventually gets there, right? It seems like a lot of that is happening anyway. Although I do expect them to do some big rip up and rewrite things. So we'll probably, you know, have another experience where everything blows up and is terrible for 3 weeks or something like that. And then suddenly it gets a lot better.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, like, it doesn't do U-turns right now, right? Never has. I mean, what is it about U-turns that's so difficult?
That's an interesting question. What is it? I mean, so a weakness that the perception, in my opinion, okay, my experience, my observing the car, it's not super good with complicated stuff that's really close to the car. And the thing about a U-turn is you have to do a pretty good job of estimating geometry of the road, you know, that's close to the car in kind of a weird location. And you might not get to see it ahead of time yet. That is, the car might not, it has to maneuver around something that's pretty close to it. I still notice there's a failure that the system has with respect to perceiving big trucks, which it kind of surprises me that it's still as bad as it is. But if you look in the display when you pass a big truck, and this is true on FSD, unfortunately, it's much more true on autopilot. But as you pass a vehicle that's quite large and quite close to you, like you're driving past a big truck, if you look at Autopilot's estimate of how close that truck is to the car, man, it's all over the place. Mm-hmm. Like it's really, it's still quite poor at estimating the location. Now, there are really good reasons why that is true, but the core of it pretty much comes down to, because of the spherical distortion of the camera lenses and the fact that they have to blend a view of this vehicle across two or three cameras to really get a sense of like where it is in space, like that's just a complicated problem to get right. But the fact that those trucks, when you're close to them and they're big, are moving around a lot, I think is probably kind of an indicator of why U-turns are still kind of hard. Because in a sense, that's a chunk of road that's where that big truck is. And to get a really good sense of it, you got to look forward and you got to look backwards and you got to stitch all that together and turn it into a set of geometry that you have a lot of confidence in. And then once you do, U-turns are one of those maneuvers where like the car's got to get it right. You know, that whole like doing three that's turns true, or something yeah. to complete it while cars are bearing down on you. Yeah. You can see it's the kind of thing that users are going to have very little tolerance for. It's going to be a frightening experience in a car. Yeah. The car's not getting it right. So, yeah. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, they've got, you know, there's test code out there with the U-turns and every single time the employees try it, they're just like, nope, not yet. And we're not going to see it until it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. I got it.
And also you almost never need U-turns, right? You almost never need left turns either. Like one thing that they haven't done that they don't do at all. And I think, you know, it's clear they don't optimize their routes in order to make them more drivable, which frustrates me because the shortest route between my house and the places I usually want to go has some unbelievably, there are turns I will not do myself because they're just totally blind turns out into high speed traffic. Mm. And the routing system just wants to go there. You know, so why is Tesla still doing that? Those are not that hard to tune out of the navigating algorithm, right? Just have it prefer stoplights or something like that to stop signs from low speed roads onto high speed roads. And you could reduce that, you know, turning onto a high speed road on a blind turn by like 95% or something like that. Why don't they do it in production? I think they'll do it. Like when they're really robotaxis out there driving around, they'll definitely prioritize going safe routes, even if they're a little bit slower, because it's just a huge win for everybody yeah. to do that. But they don't do it at all now.
I mean, do you think in the future they'll use like actual data from like driven data on specific points to determine what to do in those situations? Like, for example, I've got this one turn here in Austin where I go somewhere, it's a chiropractor, and out of coming back onto this busy road, it's an unprotected left, but it's like going 60 miles per hour and I can barely see anything. It's like crazy. It's like a death road. I'm like, that's the main route to take. If you just take a right and then just go a little bit, you can make a U-turn, and the U-turn is like, great, there's a signal and it's like, it's mm-hmm. got its own lane yeah. actually. So it's like the best thing to do. And so after doing that once, now I always go that route because it's like 100 times more safer. Do you think in the future, like Tesla can somehow, you know, use...
They will totally do that. Yeah. Like data they'll prioritize safety. And okay. a reason not to do it right now is that they want to gather... You want the most data from the hardest problems. Those are the mm-hmm. ones you're most struggling with. So if they have it do routes the easy way, it slows down their ability to capture interesting data. And they've got drivers in cars who are taking responsibility, who will intervene. And, you know, so they can rely on drivers. This is the part of the thing where we're really guinea pigs, you know? I mean, we like to think we're customers, and we are customers. I mean, I get value for this, and I think a lot of other people get value for it too. But we're also guinea pigs. We're driving a beta system, and Tesla is, you know, I think probably consciously to some extent, not making it easy on us in situations where they could, if making it easy on us means that the system improves more slowly, right? They're definitely prioritizing having the system improve faster over, you know, optimizing user comfort in the short run. Mm,
sure. Especially, I would probably use the word maybe testers, right? I mean, you've got people that are, you know, attentive and you can
Well, we're test drivers. It's, you know, I often hear this, oh, you know, so-and-so, they have professionally trained drivers. I'm like, yeah, really? What is that? Professionally trained driver. Like, don't use your cell phone when you're driving. There's your training. Now go drive. Because people get better just through experience, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that's one thing. The other thing is the idea that the employees are more motivated, like as opposed to somebody who's like out driving his pride and joy car, which he has to fix if he crashes it. Like to me, that guy, the other thing is like, he's only driving an hour a day. The employees out there, you know, they got 8 hours of like, you know, up and down the street. You know, it seems to me like Tesla's got the best possible fleet of drivers, people with skin in the game, right? Those are the people who they're going to be careful. Most of them anyway. Yeah. And you're always going to have these weird outliers, but like, man, I think they're, you know, it's a brilliant strategy that they have. We pay them and then we test the car for them.
Exactly.
We loan them the money.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
patiently wait for them to get the system working. Right. Yeah. And then, you know, and then they can kind of put us in tough spots as much as they want. Right. Because they know we really care about our cars. Right.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. All right, James. Awesome, man. Fun chatting, catching up with you. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it. I'm sure I get a lot of comments. Ton of people appreciate, actually, you generously sharing your knowledge and insights. All right. Thanks, James. Take care, and we'll see you next time.